You're listening to Fitness Rocks, the podcast that wants to change the health of the world. Fitness Rocks, it's good for your body and your soul. For more information and to find archive shows, visit www.fitnessrocks.org.
Fitness Rocks, podcast 085, Saturday, February the 16th, 2008. I'm Dr. Monty, and this week on Fitness Rocks, we're going to look at a paper published in the July-August 2007 issue of the American College of Sports Medicine's Health and Fitness Journal. The article was entitled, Timing of Energy and Fluid Intake, New Concepts for Weight Control and Hydration. The author was Dr. Dan Benardot, a professor of nutrition at Georgia State University, where he is also the co-director of the Laboratory for Elite Athletic Performance. Dr. Benardot has a research interest in energy balance and athletic performance, and he has written extensively on this subject. In the interest of full disclosure, I will tell you that his research focus on energy balance and related issues in competitive athletes has been funded by the United States Olympic Committee, the Gatorade Sports Science Institute, the Georgia Research Foundation, the American Cancer Society, and the California Horse Racing Commission. But best of all, Dr. Benardot agreed to be a guest on Fitness Rocks and share his insights on energy intake, timing, and hydration for optimal weight loss and athletic performance. This is a 36-minute telephone interview with Dr. Benardot that is packed with great information on the hows and whys to time your food and fluid intake. Thank you for your votes at Podcast Alley and your reviews at iTunes. I appreciate your support. Please visit the Fitness Rocks website where you can leave a comment about this podcast in the Fitness Rocks forum.
Dr. Benardot, welcome to Fitness Rocks.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I wanted to talk today about the article that you published in the American College of Sports Medicine's Health and Fitness Journal entitled Timing of Energy and Fluid Intake with a subtitle New Concepts for Weight Control and Hydration. I read the article and I just thought immediately that I would have to get you on the show if I could because it was such an interesting article and you describe some of the physiology that I can see people on a regular basis becoming confused about and a lot of mythology, and your article did a lot to clarify some of these issues. So I wanted to talk about it. And I guess the article really has two parts. It has a part regarding weight control or body composition control, perhaps to be more accurate, and then another segment on fluid intake. So why don't we start with the concepts of how our energy consumption or our food intake plays a significant role in our resulting body composition, because you brought up a lot of interesting points with regards to that. And that's a pretty open-ended question, but there's a lot of details we can get into. But maybe we could start with you giving us some general concepts about how we sparse out our energy intake over the course of the day, how that makes a difference in our body composition.
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that you found the article interesting. You've seen my CV, so you know that I write quite a bit, and I've got a number of books out there. But for some reason, that particular article seems to have gathered the attention of quite a few people. So I've had some opportunity now to discuss it with a number of people. You know, I think the main problem is that people think in terms of calories over units of large periods of time. So, you know, normal energy thermodynamics theory, and I'm sorry for using that phrase, but most people understand what it is when I explain it. It is, you know, if your body burns 2,000 calories and you eat 2,000 calories, then your weight will stay the same. And it can't change because you can't make energy go away and just automatically by snapping your finger. And you can't make it come in automatically. I mean, it's a very straightforward ratio. So when intake equals expenditure, weight stays the same. If you eat less than your body has expended, which is the normal principle behind most of the weight loss diets which are out there, eating less energy or fewer calories than the body expends, then your body is obligated to burn some of its own calories to make up the difference, and weight goes down. And of course, the opposite is true. If you eat more calories than your body has expended, then your body is obligated to store the excess calories and weight goes up. I think most people understand, whether you call it energy thermodynamics principle or not, most people understand that that's the way the system works. What few people, however, have thought about enough, I think, is that our storage capacity for energy or for calories is finite. And if we don't pay very special attention to those finite limitations, then I think we can get into some difficulty. So would it be okay if I gave you a little simple analogy to this?
Oh, please, yeah.
So I want you to imagine that you have an automobile that you can negotiate with. And let's say, for instance, that you wanted to drive from New York City to Chicago in this car that you can talk with. Well, you know, one fueling option that you could have with this car is to say, look, you know, I'm really in a rush. I don't want to give you any fuel right now. I want you to take me all the way to Chicago from New York. You know, you've got some fuel in your tank right now. You know, do what you have to. Get me to Chicago, and I promise you I'll give you all the fuel you needed once we get to Chicago. So that's one fueling option. Another fueling option would be something like this. It's you know, you tell your car, look, I'm going to give you all the gas you need for the entire trip. We're going to go from New York City to Chicago. I don't want to stop once we get going. I don't want to stop for fuel. So I'm going to give you all the fuel that you need right now before we leave. Now, you've got to figure out where you're going to put all this excess fuel, because I know that that fuel amounts to more fuel than your gas tank can hold. But never mind that. Figure it out. We're just going to go. And the third option is you tell your car this. Look, I'm going to fill you up before we leave, and we're going to stop about every 350 miles to fill you up again all the way to Chicago. So, you know, when I ask people which of those three options is the most logical to them, invariably everyone says option three. You have to stop every 350 miles to fuel your car because it runs out of gas, and you wouldn't go anywhere if it didn't. So it's interesting to me that people understand that concept for automobiles, but they don't get it for themselves, because, in fact, when you look at surveys of the way people eat, they're actually eating using option one or two, which is either they restrain their eating pattern during the day and then backload their intake, where at the end of the day they have an enormous dinner to make up for the energy deficits that they created earlier, or they eat too much when they have an opportunity to eat, because they know that it's really going to be a very long time before they have an opportunity to eat again. So they preload their intake. And, you know, if you look at those options, if you eat too much at one time, you're obligated to increase the size of your storage tank, or in human terms, you're obligated to increase the size of your fat mass. So body fat increases. And if you delay eating, then your body will have to use some of its own calories to make up the difference. You know, the problem with that is, yeah, you use up a little bit of your body fat, but the body's adaptation to an inadequate caloric intake is to reduce the tissue that needs calories, and that's lean tissue. So your body adapts. It's subtle, but the additive effect of it is very real. Your body adapts to an inadequate caloric intake in the midst of a day by catabolizing a little bit of muscle. It can move some of the amino acid that's in the muscle called alanine into the liver. The liver converts it to glucose. So the blood sugar stays normal and your brain can still function. The end result is that you lower the size of your metabolic engine. You can't burn as many calories now. So when you eat the way you were accustomed to eating, because you can't burn as many calories, weight goes up. So to a certain extent, what I'm saying is that alterations in body composition have a major impact on what ultimately will happen to a person's weight, because you change the calorie in, calorie out equation by altering either with too much storage of fat or by altering your capacity to burn energy.
This is what struck me about your article that was so fascinating, because you did a great job of describing or explaining the physiology behind this concept, because I'm guilty, as a lot of people are, of doing what you said at the beginning, which is to look at energy consumption in 24-hour periods of time, which obviously is wrong for the reasons that you just described.
May I just say something there? It's actually right from a weight standpoint. That is, you know, you can keep weight the same if your caloric intake matches requirement, but what constitutes that weight can change. And that's where the problem with looking at it over long periods of time makes a difference. So looking at it from a microeconomic standpoint, or fluctuations in energy balance during the day, which got you to that endpoint, actually gives you a better understanding of what can happen with body composition, what can happen with the hormonal milieu that can influence body fat, or if it's a catabolic hormone production, influence the loss of lean mass, and then ultimately weight and changes in weight. So I don't think you're wrong in thinking about it in 24 hours from a weight standpoint. I think where most people make the mistake is that you can have the same weight, but alter what constitutes that weight, and then ultimately, once you've altered what constitutes that weight or a person's body composition, then you have difficulty maintaining a certain weight because you've changed the equation, which is the energy in, energy out equation.
Yeah, and that was the interesting part, because as you pointed out, I think a lot of people tend to approach weight loss from the point of view of going for long periods of time without eating. In fact, I get a lot of emails from people asking about the benefits of fasting for 1 or 2 days. And I think a lot of, which, yeah, just I don't endorse that as a good idea, because I think there are probably more than a few reasons why it's not, and your article highlights a good one. But the concept that I think, and that I want to make sure people are clear on, is that it's important for our existence that our body work to maintain as stable a level of blood glucose or blood sugar as possible, because that's what the cells of our body use for energy, and it's what our nervous system, including our brain, uses exclusively for energy. So we have to have a stable level of blood sugar. And if we haven't eaten in a prolonged period of time, several hours, and on top of that we've exercised vigorously so that we've burned existing stores of glycogen and blood sugar, in an effort to maintain that blood glucose, one of the things our body does is, and this is going to strike people as odd, it doesn't go to our fat stores to get that, because we can't turn fat back into sugar. We can turn sugar into fat, but we can't go the other way. So it goes to
Wouldn't it be great if we could figure out a way to do that, though?
Yeah,
huh?
That would be perfect. But what our body ends up doing, as you described, is it goes to our muscles, and it takes an amino acid from our muscles called alanine, as you said, and it uses that to make blood sugar. And so we consequently, prolonged periods of not eating, or perhaps prolonged periods of eating the wrong foods, results in loss of muscle mass. And a lot of people don't realize, when they go on these bizarre diets without exercising and eating an unhealthy mix of foods, they lose a lot of weight very quickly. But what they don't recognize is that much of that weight loss may be muscle, for exactly the physiology that you have described.
That's so true. You know, I think that's part of the problem, is that people don't realize something that I said earlier, which is the body's reaction to an inadequate caloric intake is to lower the tissue that needs calories. And once that happens, then it makes it more difficult to eat the way you have habitually eaten, because now you can't burn as many calories. And so weight inevitably will go up on fewer calories, but now what constitutes your weight is more fat and less muscle. So you just perpetuate a daily difficulty of eating normally and taking in the required nutrients you need in order to stay healthy. But I think you've nailed it, exactly what happens.
Now, that's the other thing, and maybe we can only speculate on this because I don't know whether or not they've done any really good studies, but what we've just established is that going for prolonged periods without eating at all and then compounding that by exercising during that period can lead to loss of weight that might be loss of large amounts of muscle. What about another scenario where people go on some of these, what I think are bad ideas, these excessively low carbohydrate diets, where they're not consuming enough carbohydrates to maintain blood sugar levels? Are they also going to have the risk of muscle wasting, basically?
Well, you ask a very interesting question because, in fact, you know, most of the high-protein, low-carbohydrate diets which are out there are also low-calorie diets. So, you know, it's almost like a double whammy. You do lose weight on them, but that weight loss is almost always temporary. And if you look at the studies that have been published on, you know, those diets, the recidivism rate of people who go back up to their original weight after following those diets is almost 100%. I mean, it's a very small proportion of people who are able to maintain long-term their a lower weight after having been on these diets because of the very thing that we've been talking about, and that is the metabolic mass gets reduced as a result of being in a severe energy deficit. Let's think about this just a slightly different way. You know that blood sugar, doing what you and I are doing right now, just talking to each other, will flux about every 3 hours. That is, if we're just doing normal daily activity, which is not too intense, you eat, blood sugar will reach its peak about 1 hour after you eat, and about 2 hours after that, it's back to pre-meal levels, which means that you probably should have something at that point, and it doesn't need to be a lot, just to keep blood sugar normal. Because if blood sugar starts to drop below normal, then the brain gets a little bit anxious because that's your body's central processing unit, and it's sensing that it's not getting quite the electricity it needs to be getting from blood sugar, not quite enough fuel. So it'll send out signals to create its own sugar from, as you mentioned, non-sugar substances. Well, that of course is a problem. If you exercise, however, blood sugar doesn't flux in 3 hours. The harder you exercise, the more intense the physical activity, the shorter that time period becomes. So if you look at recommendations from the American College of Sports Medicine or the American Athletic Trainers Association and so on, they all recommend that if you're exercising, have something about every 10 or 15 minutes that's got a little bit of carbohydrate in it, and usually in the form of a sports beverage, so that you can both hydrate yourself and take in some carbohydrate to avoid what happens if you end up with low blood sugar, because what happens is very counterproductive to the exercise. You're exercising to improve your muscles, but if you do it with low blood sugar, you actually are catabolizing the muscles you're trying to help, and you end up with this vicious cycle of never getting any better or any healthier. So, you know, everybody gets an eating signal. You have breakfast at 7 o'clock. About 10 o'clock, most people have this signal that's being sent to their brain saying, you know, I think I need to eat. But people are so afraid of calories. They're so afraid of having some energy that they find alternatives. They'll have a diet soda, which has some caffeine in it, which, of course, is a central nervous system stimulant. So what you've done is temporarily mask the fact that your brain is searching for energy. The brain is temporarily stimulated, so it thinks it's okay. The message disappears, and you start feeling okay. But then by the time you get to lunch, the blood sugar has been allowed to drop still further. You're so hungry that you tend to overeat. And, of course, you would overeat. You know, if you have fewer opportunities to eat, then you have to eat more calories every time you have an opportunity to eat to satisfy your caloric requirements. The problem with that is if you have really large meals produce really large insulin responses. And insulin, of course, is necessary for the manufacture of fat. So it's not an arithmetic progression, the caloric insulin relationship. If you, for example, let's say you ate 500 calories and you produce 500 units of insulin. If you eat 1,000 calories, you'd like to think that you'd only produce 1,000 units of insulin. No, you would produce 2,000 units of insulin. The more insulin you have, the more energy suddenly goes into your cell. Cells don't know what to do with it, so they make more fat out of what they have been provided. So the other problem that happens is you're eating when you're hungry. Most people don't realize that hunger by itself is a hyperinsulinemic event. So the next time you eat, if you eat when you're really hungry, it doesn't matter what you eat. You'll have too much insulin produced as a result of eating, and you'll make more fat out of it. So the only solution to this is to try to figure out how you never really get hungry during the day. And at the very least, if you're doing normal daily type activities that where your heart rate doesn't get too elevated, at the very least, there should be some eating opportunity or some snacking opportunity every 3 hours so that you can normalize blood sugar. I think that's critical. And then if you're exercising, you need to have a strategy where you can sip in a few ounces of carbohydrate periodically so that you can normalize blood sugar. The alternative is very bad. I mean, the studies have shown very clearly that if you're physically active, after just about 40 minutes of physical activity, if it's unsupported with carbohydrate, you can raise blood alanine levels by 60 to 90%, which suggests that muscle is already being catabolized as a result of the physical activity. Not a very good scenario.
Yeah, and I think that I want to make sure that because that was a great bit of information. I want to make sure that we summarize that for the listeners, that what you're saying, what I interpret you saying now and in your article, is that whether your goal is weight loss or whether your goal is enhanced athletic performance, eating several, maybe six meals, small meals a day, spaced out evenly, makes a lot more sense from the point of view of maintaining stable blood glucose levels, which will also help to maintain muscle mass or lean body mass, and will encourage weight loss in the form of primarily fat loss, as opposed to eating the same amount of calories but spaced out over fewer intervals, maybe two or three times a day as opposed to six, you're more likely to wind up losing some muscle mass because during these longer periods of time without any energy, your body is going to potentially break down muscle to maintain glucose levels in your blood. And so the eating strategy would be the same for people engaged in weight loss or people engaged in enhancing athletic performance, which would be to eat several smaller meals throughout the day. Is that, in a nutshell?
Except that for people who are involved in physical activity during that period that they're physically active, then their input of energy should be perhaps even a little bit more frequent and in smaller amounts.
Sure.
So that because the blood sugar is more likely to drop much more rapidly. So, yes, but the principle, that's exactly it. It's the analogy that I gave earlier with a car. Your car has a finite gas tank. And if you want a visual for this, let's just assume that you have a standard soda can that's attached to your hip. Your goal is to make certain that that soda can never runs out and never overfills. Just like you would never want your car gas tank to run out or overfill. In the human system, well, if the gas tank runs out, obviously we're not going to stop. So the body has alternatives for finding the fuel that you haven't provided it. And if you overfill it, then the human system has wonderful mechanisms for taking the excess or the overflow out of that can and turning it into fat and putting it away. And like you said earlier, once it is fat, we can no longer call upon it as carbohydrate because we can't make that conversion, that reverse conversion from fat to carbohydrate, although the other way goes very efficiently. The problem with carbohydrates, I think carbohydrates have a bad name for a lot of people. The problem is not that we don't need them. We really need them. The problem is that our storage capacity for carbohydrates are very small, and we can overfill the carbohydrate tank very easily. So the problem is that we need carbohydrates, and they're our preferred fuel. We burn them very cleanly. We don't have a lot of metabolic waste when we burn carbohydrate. The problem is our storage capacity is small. What's the solution to that? The solution is to make sure that you have a strategy for providing carbohydrate frequently, but in small amounts, so that the gas tank never runs out and it never overfills. And when people do that, the end result is usually, you know, very good.
And of course, that's a whole different conversation because carbohydrates, you know, today carbohydrates come in the form of ho-hos and Twinkies as opposed to apples and oranges. And as I said, that's a completely different discussion that people get all hung up on. They label all carbohydrates as bad. And, you know, I would agree if your morning choices for carbohydrates are sticky buns and donuts, that's probably an unhealthy choice. Well, it's not probably, it is an unhealthy choice, but the same number of carbohydrates gotten from blueberries, apples, and oranges has enormous benefits for your health.
It can, provided you still, the caloric load, I'll give you a story in a second, provided the caloric load, even of good carbohydrates, doesn't exceed your storage capacity.
Right.
So here's an example. I had the pleasure of working with the United States marathoners just before and during the 2004 Olympic Games. And when I first started working with them, there were a couple of marathoners who would come to me after our discussions. You know, they'd come to me and say, I am really ready for tomorrow's 20-mile practice run. And I say, why? And I'd say, well, last night I just had an enormous spaghetti dinner, so I know I've gotten all of my carbohydrates in. And my response to them would be, well, congratulations, you just had a high-fat meal. And, you know, so they'd look at me with surprise and they'd say, no, I had a good high-carbohydrate spaghetti dinner. And I'm saying, yes, it started as carbohydrate, but because you ate so much at one time and your body didn't know what to do with it, it ended up as fat. Now, luckily, you're a marathoner and your oxidative capacity for burning lipids is phenomenal. So chances are it's not going to hurt you that much. But, you know, you could have followed a slightly different strategy for taking in those carbohydrates. So, for instance, instead of having that enormous meal all at one time, maybe you should have eaten a little bit of it a few hours before or a little bit of it a few hours later, just to make certain that you spread it out in such a way so that your carbohydrate fuel tank didn't overfill.
Right.
That way you can optimize your carbohydrate storage without worrying about putting in too much energy into your fat tank.
You know, I've kept you a long time, but I do want to move to one other topic, which is and you touched on it already a little bit, which is the concept of hydration and sports drinks. And I want to make something clear to the listeners, because I see this when I'm in the local gym. I see this all the time. Overweight people working out to lose weight. And they're in the gym, and they're doing this workout that, you know, they do 30 seconds on a machine, and then they rest for 5 or 10 minutes, and they gulp down these carbohydrate and salt-containing sports drinks, and then they do another 30 seconds, rest for 5 or 10 minutes. Those people, in my opinion, don't need to be drinking sports drinks, and it probably is counterproductive because they're getting more energy than they need, and they're also getting more sodium than they need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think, to me, sports drinks come into play for people who are working out with intention and who are sweating at high sweat rates, therefore losing sodium, and, as you say, burning up glucose stores quickly and need to replace them to maintain performance status. I think a lot of people are confused on that and feel like if they even drive past a gym, they better be drinking a sports drink. Why don't you give us some insight on that?
Well, let's just think about what sports drinks do, and then we can perhaps think about how they can best be applied. Sports drinks, of course, deliver fluid, which is necessary when you're exercising, because there are two things that happen when you exercise. One is that the rate at which you burn calories increases. But since we're not very efficient at converting burned calories to mechanical movement, most of the energy that we burn is actually lost as heat. So maybe only 30% of the calories that we burn when we're exercising actually goes to muscle movement. The 70% of it is actually heat loss. So unless you have a way to dissipate that increased body temperature that occurs as a result of the physical activity, then you'll stop. You'll dehydrate. You'll overheat. You have no way of cooling yourself. So, having fluids is very important to make sure that your body's capacity to sweat stays up. But also, when you're exercising, you kind of increase the requirements of what fluid is meant to do. So your blood volume normally, you'll sweat a little bit, just normal activity. It's imperceptible, but not very much. And you have a little bit of movement into working muscles of the blood, but not very much. And you don't have to get rid of a lot of metabolic byproducts because you're not metabolizing that much energy. But when you are exercising, all of a sudden the requirement for the blood volume is increased. Now there's a shift of blood volume to the periphery so that you can sweat more and dissipate the heat which has been created. And also, you have an increased requirement to make sure that the blood flow goes to the working muscles so that you can deliver energy and all of the oxidative enzymes and other blood values that help the metabolic process proceed. And also to remove metabolic byproducts from working cells so that the cells can keep on working. So the blood volume has kind of a double duty when you're physically active. Well, what happens with sports beverages? Well, sports beverages have sodium in them because sodium helps to maintain the blood volume so that you can do those double duty activities, because as soon as blood volume drops, then those two critical functions also drop. You can't cool yourself as well, and you can't deliver the blood to the working muscles quite as well, and so people have to stop exercising a little bit sooner because their endurance is negatively affected. So that's another thing that sports beverages have. They have sodium so as to maintain the blood volume. The sodium content varies tremendously between sports beverages, and some sports beverages are actually called endurance sports beverages because they have an even higher level of sodium. So, for instance, a regular sports beverage would have perhaps 100 milligrams of sodium per 240 milliliters or per cup that you drink, whereas an endurance sports beverage would have twice that much sodium because the sweat rates are expected to be voluminous when you're exercising, particularly in the heat, doing endurance activities. So you have to have an even better way to maintain the blood volume, and so you need a little bit more sodium. Those have about 200 milligrams per cup. Now, that may sound high, but that's actually less than milk. The sodium content of most sports beverages is far below that of the concentration of milk. So it's high, but still necessary. And the other thing that good sports beverages have is a little bit of carbohydrate, mainly to maintain blood volume, because the blood carbohydrate level drops rapidly when you're physically active, because that blood glucose is migrating into working cells at a much faster rate. So what the sports beverages do is to make sure that your blood volume stays steady so that your brain keeps functioning, because this is also very true. Mental fatigue, which results from low blood sugar, leads to muscle fatigue, even if your muscles have plenty of energy in them. So keeping the brain happy ends up being a very important part of keeping the exercise going and keeping blood sugar normal. So I would say this. I think people, if they consume sports beverages, don't have a clue about how to consume them properly. Most people wait until they're thirsty, and then they'll have, a large volume of sports beverages. And I think that's a little bit counterproductive. Instead, I think if people were to exercise and to tell themselves, okay, I'm going to train myself to just have one mouthful, or 1 or 2 ounces, depending on the size of the person, about every 10 to 15 minutes while I exercise. That doesn't really contribute significantly to a person's caloric load, if you drink it that way, but it contributes significantly to their capacity to exercise longer. That makes them able to burn more energy, actually, than they are consuming from the sports beverage. Now, that's completely different, of course, if people don't treat the sports beverages properly and just guzzle them down at a very fast rate, in which case the caloric load of guzzling down large sports beverage volumes may exceed the amount of energy that they're actually burning as a result of the physical activity. Yeah. So I think part of it is learning how to drink.
I just want to get clear, because people have all sorts of crazy ideas about this. For the person whose exercise program consists mostly of trying to get in a 20 or 30 minute walk every day, they probably don't need to be drinking a sports drink. Versus the person who's training for an event. Maybe they were training to run a 10K or a marathon, and they're going to be putting in some intense exercise for over an hour at a time, in a condition of high sweat. The benefits of a sport drink that you just outlined seem apparent. So is there some sort of easy-to-use guideline that you could suggest for people as to when water would be fine or when a sports drink would be appropriate?
Sure. If you're doing physical activity where you're not sweating profusely, and it really doesn't matter what it is. For instance, if you're outside working in the garden and it's 55 degrees outside and your heart rate, you know, hasn't elevated that much and, you know, you're feeling good, I would say water is just fine, you know, just because people normally get enough sodium and sugar and other carbohydrates in their diet to satisfy, you know, the liver glycogen needs to maintain blood sugar at least for, you know, 2 hours doing that kind of activity. So I would agree with you. I think water's fine. But if you find yourself in a position where heart rate is really elevated a little bit, you know, more than normal, and you are therefore sweating a little bit more than normal, I think that's the point at which you need to consider taking some sports beverages, but taking them in a reasonable way. That is to, just like with the calories, where you have to parse the intake out over reasonable intervals and with reasonable amounts, I think you have to do the same thing with sports beverages. That is to understand that they're not meant to be guzzled after you're thirsty. They're meant to be sipped on to avoid becoming thirsty. Every 10 to 15 minutes, a small amount is normally adequate. So I would say the guideline should be the degree to which sweat occurs as a result of the physical activity that you're doing.
Well, Dr. Benardo, this has been a terrific interview, and there's so much excellent information. And again, your paper was wonderful. Is there a way that I can link to, because I normally link to articles that I talk about, is there a way that this article can be linked to, that, or even just an abstract of it can be linked to, that people could look at if they want more information about this?
Yeah, I actually have a website where my books are listed and a number of articles that I've published are listed. That website's called foodandsport.com. And if you go to the nutrition downloads, there are some helpful hints there for people who are physically active, different strategies to follow. And that article is there on within-day energy balance. And there's some other sample diets. I work with figure skating and track and field, so when I work with a figure skater, I refer them to some of the information on there. So some of the information is figure skater specific, some of it is marathon specific, but some of it is just general public specific. I think people could go on there and get a lot of that information, including that article is up on that website, foodandsport.com.
I will definitely provide a link to that website in the show notes of this podcast, but for those people who don't go to the show notes, that's going to be FOODANDSPORT, just to make sure that...
Well, food and sport, all written out, no ampersand, FOODANDSPORT.com.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for being on Fitness Rocks today, Dr. Benardo.
It's been a pleasure. Good talking with you. Hope we have future opportunities.
And that'll do it for Fitness Rocks Podcast 085. You can tell me what you think about this podcast by posting a comment in the Fitness Rocks forum at fitnessrocks.org. Thanks to Dr. Benedot for sharing his expertise with us. You should definitely check out his website at www.foodandsport.com. Thanks to our musicians, Charlie Crow playing Crow Jam at our introduction and John Schmidt playing All of Me to wrap up the show. You can find their music on the web at podshow.com. Fitness Rocks is not intended as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have a specific medical question or condition, please seek care from your primary care physician. Do not use the information provided in the Fitness Rocks podcast or at the Fitness Rocks website without first discussing it with your doctor. Until next week, this is Dr. Monty. Have a great workout.